Okay. This is on. Good. I promised yesterday a psychological look at how the loss of mindfulness could be experienced. Yeah. So many of you are therapists or psychologists, or all of us are suffering. So how does it actually look when mindfulness is lost? How does the absence of mindfulness look, or the preoccupation of mindfulness with some other things? How does it look? Yeah. Meditators are aware there are such things as the five hindrances in Buddhist meditational teaching, which is very straightforward. Three and a half of those five hindrances deal with thought. Yeah. The five hindrances is very simple. It's sense desire, it's aversion and ill will. That's number two. Number three is sleepiness, drowsiness, numbness. Yeah, that's number three. Number four is restlessness, physical. That's the first part of number four. And the second part of number four is agitation. This is not physical, this is of your conscience, of your mind. And hindrance number five is called doubt. Number four. Agitation. It's an ethical quality in your heart that says you have not acted in ways you should have acted. It's something like your conscience. Yeah. Oh, you should know Christians, you know. Oh, they're very good in this, you know. Particularly Christians who have no longer belief in God. Yeah, that's the worst. You know, you still have the Christian habits, but you have no more God to take care of you. This is the worst condition you can have. So God is gone, but your guilt is still here. Yeah. This is the worst condition. I think Jews are a lot better off. You would.
Guilt is together with the restlessness?
It's the same hindrance, yeah. Let me say that in Pali. Udaccha is the physical restlessness and kukucha is the mental agitation. Now, it's not that your ethical sensibility is a bad thing. In Buddhism, this is a good thing. So if you have a conscience that complains about your actions and about the things you don't do, this is considered a good thing. The problem is, if this happens in your formal meditation practice, where you can't actually change anything, you know, where this kind of agitation of your heart or of your mind stops you from being more still, it's a bad thing there. It's not generally a bad thing. You know, it's good to have a conscience. It's good to have ethical sensibility and moral awareness. But as a hindrance, it means you keep repeating the things that you have not done well. You keep feeling bad about yourself. And at the same time, you're sitting there trying to look like an angel with your legs crossed and you can't do anything. So you can't fix it. You can't repent. You can't say sorry. You can't do anything. Yeah. So that's the classical guilt trip. Psychologically, this is definitely a malfunction. Yeah. And it's generally connected with some sort of self-punitive behavior. I don't know how to translate that. It has something to do with hitting yourself, you know. You have done bad things, so right now you're going to punish yourself for bad things. And so one way you can punish yourself is you stop yourself from becoming still and peaceful. So you make yourself crazy with bad thoughts. So that's what kukucha means. It's the sense of moral responsibility, the sense of ethical conscience gone wrong. Yeah. Something that is healthy and good is being abused to punish yourself, to make yourself agitated. I can write those down, actually, if this is helpful. I thought you were all, you know this all by heart, because you are experienced meditators. Yeah. Can this be red color? So in Pali they're called Nivarana. How we call that, sloth and torpor. These two are counted as one here. Sloth means kind of, and torpor means you don't move. Yeah, it's important to understand this is not just sleepiness. Yeah, this is not just sleepiness. This is also numbness. Yeah, so you don't feel anything. This is a quality of insensitivity. Yeah, a kind of heightened physical somatic indifference. You can't hear, you can't see, you know, your senses are dull. Yeah. Sometimes people translate this as dullness. The image in Pali, the word in Pali, Tinamida speaks of rigidity and lack of sensitivity. So sleep is one of the things that does that. That's the most common one. But sometimes people have stuporific states. Stupor. This kind of thing, yeah?
Again?
Stupor is a kind of, you don't feel properly, you are rigid, you feel paralyzed.
Like clumsy.
No, not clumsy. You want a DSM-4 number for it, isn't it? At the worst end of the spectrum is catatonia, yeah. But generally, meditators don't struggle with catatonia. They struggle with simpler forms of it. Yeah, they struggle with just nothing goes in anymore. They hear the sounds, but the dots don't connect anymore, or they can't stay awake, or their minds don't think, or their senses don't. You know, it's all like under milk glazing. You know, it's opaque. You don't see actually. Can't see clear anymore. So it's a reduction of sensory precision. On one level.
What causes this?
Well, this is. That's a good question. I'm not even trying to explain you. I'm trying to describe the phenomenon because if you meditate, you will sooner or later meet that. Yeah, I won't take any person serious as a meditator unless they have actually met this hindrance. You know, every serious meditator will have to struggle with sleepiness, drowsiness, numbness sooner or later. This is the normal. Development. It's a developmental stage, at least. If you tell me you meditate for a long time and you never have that, I have great suspicions about the efficiency of your meditation. I think you need to go there, actually. This is part of a mind that is lethargic. Yeah?
Is it the opposite of, let's say, clarity? Or
No, if you want to really have an opposite, then it's the opposite of restlessness. obviously, clarity would be, stillness would be halfway in between. If it's cognitive, it would be clarity. If it's somatic, it would be stillness. You know? So it's generally a lack of energy, or more often, an energy that has gone stale, yeah, that has become stuck somewhere. So stuckness of energy is generally the reason for this lethargy, this sleepiness or not sensing properly.
It's kind of a shutdown.
Yes, mm-hmm. Precisely. And that is sometimes the reason for it. Yeah. Well, I mean, we can talk about these. I wasn't thinking of doing that, but we can talk a little bit of this. You know, sense desires is straightforward. It's basically our wish to have experience. Yeah, we are, even you may think that you're not a particularly desirous type. Yeah, you may think of yourself as just normal. Yeah, not particularly greedy, not particularly longing. But we have lots of sense desire. Our senses want to be stimulated. In fact, our senses need to be stimulated. Developmentally, we don't develop very well if we are not receiving appropriate stimulation, you know, as kids. In fact, if we are not appropriately stimulated, then our growth and sensory development is retarded. You know, if it's really bad, it's not just retarded; it's atrophied. You know, there's no doubt that this is absolutely necessary for growth. It takes a kid several months to figure out actually its own sense channels by appropriate stimulation. Generally, in Buddhist psychology, you would say the Vedana quality is very quickly in place. Like it, not like it, but what it actually is, what it likes. It takes months. You can read it up in Piaget about, you know, developmental stages in early childhood. So sensory stimulation is absolutely indispensable for growing up. But by the time we are grown up, and most of you seem to have done that job pretty well, by the time we are grown up, we actually have habits. We seek continual stimulation of our senses. There is, psychologists will know that, there is something, I don't know how to call that in Hebrew, that is called functional pleasure, that is derived from sense activity, plain activity, not even doing things you like, but just using the sense organ is rated as already pleasurable. We only notice that when, for some reason, either by choice or involuntarily, we are deprived of sensory experience. Yeah. So sometimes you fast for a while. Yeah. This would be a voluntary act of sensory deprivation, because obviously we're not just eating food, we eat enjoyment, isn't it? We eat the earth element. We do a lot of sense gratification by eating. And one of the difficult things about fasting is if that falls away, it's not just food that falls away and the body is hungry, but actually we look forward to eating, because eating is something we like doing. It's a very regular stimulation of our senses. We like to share that with other people, so it's a social act. And it is pleasant. If you have a choice in what you eat, and if you're healthy, then you enjoy eating. It's something you like to do. So there are other ways, like sometimes, you know, sometimes people have accidents and lose the sense of taste. I had for a fluke of history, I had connections with several people who have lost, through accidents, their sense of taste. So they were deprived of gustatory experience. Now, if you can think of losing one sense, then to lose the sense of taste would seem to be the easiest sense to lose. Yeah, it's a lot better than losing your sense of sight or your sense of touch, or even losing proprioception is a catastrophe, as you probably know. Your sense of taste feels, you know, you can live without that. But people undergo severe depressions when they lose their sense of taste. They lose severe eating becomes an unpleasant experience. You have only texture, but no longer taste. Yeah? You only feel the stuff rather than tasting it. And it's very, very painful. People struggle with that. It takes joy out of their lives. It doesn't make sense cooking for their kids if they can't smell or taste, whether it's salty or good. Yeah? So very difficult. Many people struggle with depression, just losing taste. They can still have sex, they can still drive cars, they can still, you know, think, they can still move, they're not blind. Yeah, but sense of taste is important. We only notice that if we don't have much to taste anymore. Some people practice going into the dark for a while, not seeing light. Yeah? Or some people try not to speak for a while. Yeah? Any sort of experience of that nature gives us an experience of deprivation. Isolation particularly is dramatic. Not being with other people, not connecting with other people. This does very profound things to us. So we need sensory stimulation. We feel quite weird. Our inner structure starts falling apart. Anybody who has worked with people who come from, you know, imprisonment, insulation, imprisonment is disastrous what it does to the psyche. Yeah. So our senses are very much at the base of our attachment. We identify with sense content. We need sense contact. We seek sense experience all the time, even if we're not aware of it. Most of the time, we're not aware of it. We think of sense desire. We think of food and sex and going nice places and listening to nice things and experiencing extraordinary states. But the truth is, most of the time, our sense desire isn't geared for ecstatic intensity. Yeah? Most of the time, our sense desire is geared for comfort. It's geared for pleasantness. It's not geared for the peak experience. It's geared for nice, agreeable, lovely, comfy, you know. We're looking for baby sense contact, you know, kind of nice, you know, nice in taste, nice in light, nice in color, nice in touch, nice in textile. We're looking for the nice bit. We're not looking generally for the peak thing. There are a couple of times we really look for the big hit, yeah. So we threaten these poor bodies to jump with a bungee rope over an old bridge. Yeah? And we terrorize these poor bodies and threaten death to them. And then when they survive, they give off fantastic endorphin hits. Yeah? And for the next 3 days, we don't sleep anymore and we are completely alive, utterly alive. Yeah? So sometimes we do this kind of thing. But we don't want sex all the time, you know. We don't want lots of exquisite cuisine all the time. Most of the time, we just want to be nice. We just want to have it nice enough, you know, comfortable enough. So that's still sense desire. In fact, Buddhists are very strict. They say thinking, images in your head are also senses. Yeah. So thinking about pleasant things is sense desire. And in fact, that's why this thing is here in this list. Because we're talking, these are hindrances for meditation, yeah? Formal meditation practice. This is important to know. So sense desire in formal meditation practice, when you sit here, eyes closed on the ground, means you think, yeah? Your sense desire shows up as thought, as fantasy, as memory, as something that is pleasant, and you decide to spend time on feeling the aftertaste of it, yeah? Or feeling the anticipation of it, yeah? So you think pleasant things and you feel good. It's not as good as having the thing, but it at least feels a little bit as good as having the thing, yeah? Some things feel better anticipating than when you actually get them, yeah? Mm-hmm. Jacques Lacan has a lot to say about this. Petit objet and so forth, yeah? Our fantasies have to be unrealistic for it to be effective fantasies. They have to be unrealistic. Nobody wants realistic fantasies. Yeah? Realistic fantasies never give you as much energy as unrealistic fantasies. Yeah? So there's a lot to say about Buddhist teaching,
when
actually.
When you make meditation, you're not supposed to have fantasies.
Right.
Yeah.
I perfectly agree with you. That's why these things are hindrances.
That's why
That's why these things are hindrances.
What does it mean, hindrances?
Okay.
Okay, let me be straight. These are problems, yeah? For meditators. This is not what you're supposed to have. This is what you're not supposed to have. But since you're all having this, yeah? Sorry to say. Since you're all having this, yeah? Before you have jhanas, this is what is happening in your meditation. You know, it doesn't matter what you call it, dzogchen, chikantazar, vipassana, this is happening, okay? This is psychology. Buddhist psychology, this is happening. So whatever name we're going to give it, you're going to meet these. And if you meet them, it's better you know them. Yeah? Better you recognize them. So this one is thinking. The first one is thinking. The second one is also thinking. Yeah? Ill will and aversion will show up as negative feelings. You don't want to have this experience. You get angry when you have this thought. This image makes your heart constrict. This gives you this aversion, ill will gives rise to feelings of negativity. You want to hurt, you want to punish, you want to at least push away this. So this is thought as well. Sloth and torpor is not thought. That's a very honest obstacle. This has nothing to do with thinking. You're just kind of no energy. System shut down. Restlessness also, this is not thinking. The first part of number four. Let's give them straight numbers, that makes it more clear. Are we so far clear on the translation?
Sloth and torpor is to the armor pellet to the apiha.
Thank you. Then agitation again is thinking. Yeah? And doubt is also thinking. So of those five hindrances, three and a half have to do with thought. So if you tell me that thought is the problem in your meditation, I would ask you, well, what kind of thoughts do you have? Do you have desire thoughts or ill will thoughts or agitation thoughts, or do you have doubt?
Doubt about what?
Anything. But generally about yourself. Generally about whether you're good enough, whether you can do it, doubt about the Buddha, the validity of the teaching, of the method. But generally it's doubt about yourself. Can I do it? Have I a congenital anti-vipassana disease which stops me from... You know, is this good for everyone, but for some weird genetic reason I'm incapable of being mindful? Or doubt about the teacher, you know? He doesn't really understand. He doesn't know what he's talking about. Generally, it's doubt that is a question you feel you shouldn't have. You know, there are many questions we don't that are not doubts. There are simple questions. Yeah, it's a simple question mark. But there are questions you feel you shouldn't have. You shouldn't have the doubt whether you should continue living with your wife or not. You know, generally this feels bad because you feel since you're living with her, you shouldn't have that doubt. Or here, they're generally concerned with ethics. Is this good? Is this justifiable? Is this ethically okay? Can I live with that decision? Yeah. So these are big questions. And questions which you cannot resolve by clearly thinking. You know, some things are doubtful in life, but here we're speaking of formal meditation practice, so doubt is not something you can resolve at that moment. Usually doubt is an emotion. Doubt sits generally here, and you try to fix it here. So, because the emotion is unpleasant and says, I shouldn't have this, this shouldn't be as it is, you try to fix it up here by probability scenarios, you know. 9 reasons that speak in favor... 9 reasons that speak against. And obviously you can never win with doubt. You know, because it's an emotion. No emotions go away with thinking. You know, you cannot pacify emotions with thinking. And particularly not strong emotions. You know. Neurologically it's very difficult. Your amygdala has a lot more messages
to go to your neocortex, then your neocortex has ability to give messages back to your amygdala. Yeah? So fear is out, anxiety is out, depression, very difficult. There are emotions you can modulate, obviously, with thought, and you can, in the long run, strengthen neural connections, even back to the amygdala.
As a thought, why you do meditation, or as a thought, why you do psychologist therapy, commissaire?
No, we're speaking, these are meditation obstacles. Okay. This is, the situation for these obstacles is formal meditation practice. Your decision is to gain clarity, gain stillness, gain samadhi, and pacify your mind. That's what you want to do, and those hindrances will turn up. Let me say something about this one, sloth and torpid drowsiness, because psychologists need to be aware of this. This much of this hindrance has not to do with tiredness or with lack of sleep. Sometimes this is the case, but many times this lethargy and no energy has to do with resistance. Yeah? It has to do with unacknowledged resistance in the meditator. He or she does not really want to be here. Or, you know, there is part of your mind that wants to know, but another part of your mind, whom you don't listen to, but who is nevertheless there, says, I don't want to know. So as soon as I go there, as soon as he pushes me there, I just get tired, okay? He can push me there, but I'm not going to play along. I fall asleep. Anytime it goes close to where it hurts, I just go very tired. Yeah. I can't stop him from pushing me there, but I'm not going to go along. You know, I just kind of get very tired. Yeah. So sometimes the mind does this as an act of resistance, particularly with people who are very will-oriented. Yeah. People who are strong in producing will, they push, but somehow they don't negotiate with the resistance. The resistance is not acknowledged. And then the net result of the resistance and the pushing part is just kind of system shut down. You look as if you've never experienced that. I'm surprised.
So what do you do when you encounter such a resistance with a client, for example?
What do you do with yourself? What do you do with yourself when you encounter that in your own experience? I'm grateful for your question, because obviously this will also show up in your client work, but my hunch is you're a lot better with that in your client work if you have experience of your own resistances and negotiating your own resistances. Mine, generally, they need validation. My resistances need validation. You know, my first step of being able to negotiate with resistance is actually acknowledging that they are there. Because part of me doesn't want to have this resistance, so I pretend to not have them as long as I can. Unless they really, you know, block. I try not to acknowledge them. So that is what provokes them in the first place. They become somatic, yeah? They kind of cut my energy or make me restless. That's another one, yeah? Whenever, sometimes resistances make us itchy. I think the first thing is really saying, oh, well, actually, obviously, something's there that doesn't want what I want. Or I am not the only one who wants anything, something here. You know, there are other personality aspects here that don't agree with this general direction. Then I think an authentic interest in what the resistance wants to protect or wants to avoid, or what that part of my self-construct I don't want to acknowledge actually wishes or is afraid of. Usually it's that. It wants something. Most often it's afraid of and doesn't want something. It wants to protect something.
To make the connection to whatever resistance there is. I mean, if there is sleepiness,
yeah.
How would we make the, how would we find out?
Well, you fall asleep.
Not for me, but to...
You fall asleep and you notice that you fall asleep, you know. In meditation, it's very easy.
would I know what's causing it?
Well, your curiosity, your consistent curiosity, you know. You notice that you fall asleep, yeah, because meditator, you know, the first sense to go in meditation is the sense of balance, yeah. So anybody falling asleep in meditation generally has some changes in their posture, yeah? Falling off the, you know, like the parrot falling off the batten, basically. So there's many ways of how it looks when somebody falls asleep. You know it in a therapy sessions, their eyes glaze over, their breathing gets funny, their look becomes vacant, hardening in their faces. You know when somebody kind of goes into a frozen state or a state of absence. You know, it's not difficult to recognize. In meditation, it's even simpler. You know, you just notice that you can't keep your attention steady, and then you notice, if you're good, you notice where the physical symptoms of tiredness are noticeable in your body. You know, me, it's my eyes here, sort of lead. Then something in my breath gets harder. Then there's a kind of tension up here in my upper chest. And then usually there's kind of a sinking, yeah. Something in my spine changes. And then you lose your angle. Usually your head sinks, or at least your, you know, the axis of your eyes are kind of sinking. Yeah? Sometimes you hunch, yeah? And then, you know, sometimes people nod, actually, kind of do this, or dramatic, you know, bolt upright, and then suddenly, dunk. You know? There's many variants of this, you know. I had a friend who was doing an ascetic practice when he was a monk. So he was not lying down when he was at night, just not. And he would lean against the wall. Yeah, that's what he allowed himself to do. And long after he had stopped practicing this kind of way, he kept having this habit. You know, his body kept looking for the wall, even though he, by that time, he was sleeping now. But his body had taken the habit of looking for the wall whenever he felt sleepy. Yeah. So usually this is in meditation, people feel ashamed of this. Yeah, when they kind of nod or fall off, or they think this is bad. It looks bad. It's public, you know. Most of these things, they don't look public, you know. You can have the wildest fantasies and still look pretty peaceful. But sleepiness, it's everybody can see it. Yeah, you come into the meditation room, everybody's sitting, and then there's this guy in the front row that does this, you know. So it's very easy to see. So we feel ashamed of this. So we try to not have it. We try to make it go away. And that's generally what helps it to become stronger. So our resistance against acknowledging the sleepiness is generally what makes us less aware of sleepiness, because we try to push it aside as long as we can. And when we can't push it aside anymore because it's so strong, we have very little leeway. We have very little options to work with it. So if you want to actually work with it, you need to be interested in your sleepiness, which is what we not are normally. Yeah? You have to be actually interested in the first warning signs of sleepiness. I'm not just telling this to you. I tell this to all of you. It's just that you have asked. And then when you are able to stay with the sensation of sleepiness, your chances are best to actually counteract it. If the sleepiness keeps occurring, you know, you're bright awake, you come in, somebody tells you, meditate, and you fall asleep. And you generally, and then somebody rings a bell, you know, and you're bright awake again. Usually that's an indication that you are not just tired. You know, it's an indication that something about your sleepiness has to do with what's happening in your meditation. Now, this may be quite normal. You know, if your life is painful right now, and sitting still and closing your eyes amplifies your inner experience of a painful life, then one way of making this more bearable is just by shutting down. You know? So it's understandable that when you shut down, your pain is less strong. So it's kind of a normal experience. It's not something to be ashamed of. Only, it's not very useful at helping the mind to become more clear or more still or more insightful. So you need to seek a relationship with that, what is painful. You need to find interest in this. Go there. Go in the body and see what comes up in your mind when you stay in this part in the body, for example. Or acknowledge the state of mind that is connected with a particular body sensation. Yeah? So you need to do what you do to a friend, basically. If she's hurting, you go close to her, you sit. Yeah? You don't push, you don't say, give me the whole story. You just you go and empathetically feel what is happening for her. You go and share the space with her. Yeah? And then maybe she starts talking, or maybe you ask, what really happened, or what's the worst of it, or how are you doing? Hey, I'm here. Talk to me. You kind of establish a connection with this part that is blocked or resists. And if you're doing that properly, then it will start to talk, because it wants to be known. It wants to be felt. It is a resistance because it feels it deserves some of your attention and you have not given it. So it's like a real relationship with some other being. You need to kind of acknowledge presence, show interest, be welcoming, not be intrusive, respectful, curious, gentle. this guy, what you would like if you don't feel well. That's how the meditation teaching suggests you meet that part of yourself. And then that part will start talking. It will probably give you images. It will probably give you sentences. And it's not something probably that can be fixed in your meditation. Your meditation generally tells you about problem, but it can't be fixed in your meditation. I hate to say that because it's really bad advertisement. We like to advertise meditation makes you happy, vipassana makes you clear and awakened. But much of meditation actually shows you the problem. Now, the problems for these things, they're all in your life. They're not in your meditation. That's just where they show up. But these things have to do with the rest of your lives. So that's where they can be fixed. You can't fix the thing that is the reason for agitation in meditation. You have to fix that in your life. Obviously, your conscience tells you that you're not doing well in some aspect of your life. You're doing things that you later regret, that you feel guilty about, that you feel you lose self-respect. So this cannot be fixed in meditation. This has to be fixed in your life. That's where you come in as therapists, people. Yeah. Yeah, you could turn it that way. It's also a bad thing because, in meditation you could actually find a lot of strength. You could find a lot of clarity and a lot of goodness. And because of these things are there, you find less goodness, you find less strength. Your mind doesn't calm down. Yeah? So it's like, yes, you become aware of the problem, but some of the resources you don't have access to. So that's why they're called hindrances. But obviously, the only psychologically realistic approach is exactly what you say. This makes you aware of things that need looking at and changing probably in your life. Yeah. That's why life and meditation need to go together. That's why therapeutic work and meditation need to go together, if you're asking me. Yeah. Let me have a quick word to the rest. Yeah. There's another reason that can have to do with sleepiness or lethargy in meditation. Sometimes your psyche decides that the stuff you need to look at, you have not enough resources. Yeah? right now you don't have enough ground to actually confront something in a big way. So your psyche just closes down and says, as a protective measure, sorry, we do emergency shutdown here. Yeah? You're coming into trauma realm now, right now. This is not safe enough here. Not enough support, not enough good people, not enough structure for me to go into major psychological work. Yeah? So I'm just shutting down this process. Sorry. Yeah. Emergency break. We're just it costs a lot of energy. It disturbs the direction of my practice, but we're closing down here because this is not happening. This is too risky. You have sort of an emergency systems in your psyche. And again, that means basically this is a protective measure. We have to think of this as something good. As you know, as therapists, it's a very unfair and not very moral thing to take away people's defenses before you have something else to offer them. Yeah. This was the days are over when we thought we need to crack open defenses at all cost. Yeah. These days are over. Yeah. We've gone through our Reichian programs and we've been hitting our pillows long enough. This is over. We have understood that defenses have a purpose, and in the developmental understanding of growth, defenses in place is not a bad thing. The question is, you know, how much can we risk opening these defenses? And that has to be measured and gauged according to your context. How healthy you are, how well you're integrated, how safe the outside is. That's why people come to retreats, because we create safety in retreats. We say, we're not stealing, we're not flirting, we're not trying to hit each other, we're not trying to sell each other stuff, we don't want your soul, we give you a safe situation, morally safe situation. You're being looked after, you're being fed, you have a clear schedule, we're going to stick to that. This is a teacher, he doesn't do any voodoo on you, he's... and so forth. Yeah, we create safe spaces. And in that safe space, you know, we're then allowed to make inquiries into the places where we feel vulnerable, yeah, where we feel not safe. I'm only making such experiments if I feel safe outside. If you're shooting at me or if you're nasty to me, I will be probably more concerned being vigilant what you do than what's happening here. Yeah. So that's one of the aspects of retreat. We create safety and we make people feel as much as we can at home, and then we allow them to actually more deeply get in touch with what's happening. And some of the stuff that's happening will be part of this. Yeah? Questions more to the Nivarana? Yeah, please.
Are you doing something wrong in your meditation if you don't come across ill will and aversion?
No, not everybody is nasty and full of ill will and aversion, you know. If you're a full-blown desire type, you will be having probably a lot more desire. Or if you're really sleepy, then you probably never have aversion. You just sleep whenever aversion comes. Yeah. Or if you have so much self-doubt, then aversion would be actually a preferred option, you know, but you don't have it. So not all people have all of them. If one of them is dominant, all the others generally are less dominant. But, you know, there are other things than meditation hindrances in your practice. You know, you may be actually loving or joyous or equanimous or compassionate. No? This is not all that's happening. This is just some of the things that are problems. You know? You don't have to have them. But if you have them, it's good to recognize them. Because generally, if you don't recognize sense desire, you just keep following nice thoughts, you know? You don't recognize the desire part. All you think is holiday and Peter and food and, you know, where do I go from next? The same way for ill will. If you don't recognize aversion speaking here, then you think about the people. It's generally always people, you know. Number two is generally always people. usually you're not averse against the grass or so, or, or the sky or the trees. It's generally people who make you averse. So you keep thinking about those people without recognizing that the energy that gives power to that thought actually is ill will, and that you're totally responsible for that. Not the people you think are responsible for your ill will, but you are responsible for ill will. And if you keep thinking about that long enough, you will notice that your ill will also go to other people. You believe you're particularly annoyed and averse against him because he did that. But when you've been sitting for a couple of months or years, you realize that your tendency to ill will is quite independent of people. You know, you will be able to hate many different people. In fact, on good days, you will hate everybody, even the ones who love. You know? So at that stage, you notice that you can't really blame the people who are the content of your ill will thought for the experience of ill will, that there is something, a latent reservoir of ill will in your mind that just chooses occasional different people. And you will need to take care of the ill will. And then the same people you have had ill will towards will become people you that give you joy. Yeah. Please. Mm-hmm. And do you like having creative thoughts?
I like it because it's advancing me in my life. I know that it's not supposed to be.
Why not?
Because I'm supposed to meditate.
Yeah.
It takes me, but it's like really amazing the the progressing I have in my walk, in my things when I.
Which one would you think it is on the list?
Maybe sense design?
You know, creativity, particularly the wish to be creative, because, you know, to be creative is one thing, but then to actually hope you're going to be even more creative, or hope to work a little bit on that creativity. This is desire. Yeah. You're going to make a choice. Yeah. You will have to make choices. If you make the choice to follow the creative thought, then you will have the value of the creative thought. Maybe it's genuinely creative and advances you in your life. Then you will have the benefit of that. And the cost will be your mind will not be still. Yeah, yeah, I understand.
I'm curious to know why it's happening.
Well, because you have created the space. Because you have made this time extraordinary. Because you're actually willing to sit down with yourself. Because you're not doing what you usually do. Because you're less busy. Because you've come to a special place and a special situation to be with more of your inner experience. Because of that attitude, these things talk more. Yeah? They're more, they notice, oh, she's listening now. Yeah? She's never time for me. You know? She's always so busy. She's preoccupied living down her diary, yeah? Ticking off her client hours or whatever. And she doesn't have time for me. But now she has time. Now she's listening. Now I'm talking to her. So if you do more meditation, you will even have more of those, you know, more profound. But you need to, you know, it's like you go to the shopping mall. If you just buy the first stuff that is on the shelf, it's not maybe not the best stuff. So to get to the good stuff, you need to let go of the not so good stuff. Yeah, you need to basically what psychologists would call delay gratification. Yeah, it's generally rated as a sign of maturity.
Yeah.
So if you let go of your first 10 creative thoughts, maybe creative thought number 11 will be really, really sublime. But no guarantees, you never know. Maybe it just stop. Maybe number 10 was the last one, that's true. The last one ever. You see, this hindrances, some of the stuff is nice. Yeah, many of these things are actually nice. Particularly sense desire is nice. People who have sense desires are generally nice people. They like to share. They like to enjoy. They see the beauty in things. They see the pleasure in things. They enjoy more when there is more people sharing. So generally desire people are very pleasant characters. Yeah, they have a warmth. They're inviting. They're kind. Yeah. So many of these things look attractive. That's not the problem. The problem is not the joy or the pleasure or the stimulation you get from this. The problem is that you're following this pleasure with attachment. Yeah. Something in you wants to have it, own it, repeat it, marry it, keep it, yeah, this kind of thing. And the seeking of this, of the repetition of this experience, is what keeps the mind moving. And this is what keeps stillness away. Yeah. So the problem is not the creative aspect or the pleasure aspect. The problem is the attachment to it. And the repetition in seeking. That's what stops the mind from becoming quiet. With ill will, it's more easy. It's generally unpleasant. We like to get rid of it. Only part of our wanting to get rid of it is also ill will. Yeah. It's a desire to actually push things aside, stop it, terminate. I'll tell you more about this in a moment. Okay. Yeah, other questions, please.
Okay. Yesterday we were talking about different aspects or qualities of mindfulness.
Yeah.
One of them was being a participant with your mind.
Yeah.
In a very active way.
Yeah.
Which could lead to kind of self-therapy. And now we're talking about meditation, which is the best form of being mindful. And we're talking about restlessness, and which leads you to some kind of investigation, self-investigation.
Uh-huh.
And then when you realize that, okay, I found out something really interesting, like I live with a big dilemma or something. But you still say you can't fix it during meditation. You can only watch it from the outside. But still you are being very mindful. Why can't you use this moment or tool to try to fix it in a way? To investigate it more?
Let's make a couple of distinctions here. You know, restlessness, basically, all of these things are ways in which your mind keeps itself occupied. Yeah? This activity will stop the mind from becoming more still, more clear, more changeable in a sense towards happiness, towards understanding. Yeah? So all these things are part of our experience, and all these things, when you give them your permission, and you let them run, they will keep your agitation in your mind. They will keep your mind moving. So if your intention is to still your mind, because you know if it is more still, it is more creative, it is more fertile, it understands better, it is less pulled aside by thoughts and emotions, it is in many ways a more profound experience, that deeper stillness, then this is the reason why you should not give these things your energy. But, yeah, having said that, some people actually need to investigate their anger, you know. It's good for them to feel their anger. In fact, it's good for them to even be angry, a little bit angry. Yeah. On the long run, it's not good for them, but some people actually need to learn this. So just to meditate it away will not do the job. These are developmental stages. In the long run, you don't want these things, basically because they take you away from the most profound aspects of your experience. Yeah. It is those things that stop you from getting in touch more deeply with what is real and what makes happy and what is making you basically capable of growing up. But it may be necessary to investigate the specific nature of, say, your restlessness or the specific nature of your doubt as a project, outside even of meditation.
Okay, why outside? Maybe some of the practice should be directed to this. Is it okay?
Look, if you don't have a certain degree of stillness in your practice, then your investigation will basically default to thinking. It will default to analytical discursive processes, which you don't even need to meditate for that. You can just continue doing that without doing meditation. See? Meditation is a different layer. You shift emphasis on another layer of your mind. And to be having access to that layer in your mind, you need to postpone your preoccupation with the top surface layer. It will only ever happen. You know, if you want to dive and if you want to see the corals, you need to stop playing with the waves, you know. Although the waves are nice, there's a countless number of different waves. Some of them have shiny crowns and counter light. They look particularly beautiful. And there's green waves and grey waves and high waves and waves from two directions. But if you want to see corals, you need to stop playing with the waves. You need to go past the stage where waves are. And you need to go beneath the surface and go down. Yeah. This is just the nature of mind. It's not even Buddhism. You know, every contemplative tradition has understood, as long as you play around with conceptual discursive thought, you will find generally conceptual discursive thought is propelled by these forces: doubt, agitation, sense, desire, ill will. You know, there's a lot of seeking and avoiding, a lot of negotiating. And as long as you seek understanding on that plane, this is the plane you will find your answers on. If you want to find corals, you need to dive underneath that, definitely. So, yes, it may make sense to do investigations. I love thinking, as you probably have realized, but this is not what I believe is going to solve questions in my life. Yeah. So, if I want to be more still, I need to give up the plane of thinking, however fascinating my thoughts are, however justified my anger may be, you know. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, you see, I'm making this more different than it actually is. Yeah. If you actually dive, any one moment you dive, you know, you sit an hour in meditation, you dive in. Yeah, there's a moment where you actually have, where there is still a lot of thought, yeah, and you can't help noticing certain patterns in these thoughts, so you can't help noticing certain connections between body and thought or emotion and thought. And if you dive in enough times, you will recognize this becomes very familiar terrain. You know, it's like you drive past places and you know, oh, this is growing there. Yeah, it's only growing there. Yeah, this plant is only growing there. I'm actually never really go there, because I want to drive past somewhere else, but actually I know they grow there. If I want to be more interested in these plants, I can stop and kind of look at them. This becomes possible because you know the route, yeah, from thought to stillness. Does that make sense?
In a way, but there's something I'm not sure I understand, because I understand what you're saying, that during meditation, I mean, you should concentrate on becoming still and avoid that.
Well, that's one aspect, you know. If you meditate with me, I've just finished an 11-day retreat here. That's what I tell people the first 3 days. After 3-4 days, I tell them they should actually be interested, what are the things that stop them from meditating more deeply, yeah? They should actually investigate with a meditative stillness at the back of their minds into the very issues that keep coming and keep stopping them from even deeper stillness. Yeah? I just don't believe that you can do that right from the beginning. I just don't believe that anymore. I don't believe in vipassana from day one, you know, because that type of vipassana doesn't transform. It just means I'm sitting here thinking about my life in terms of in which I think about it anyway, even outside of my meditative experience. So there is no doubt in my mind that it is necessary for us to regulate the intensity, the speed, and the complexity of our discursive thinking. And there is no way you can do that by continuing to think, because thought never leads to stilling thought, never. It's rabbits, it leads to more rabbits, you know. Two rabbits, and then more rabbits, and then many more rabbits, and then just rabbits. Yeah. So that's what thoughts do. That's their nature. And if you want an understanding that is pre-discursive, then you have to be consciously leaving that plane behind, however nice the rabbits look up there. Mm-hmm. I have no doubt about this. But I do think it is useful to play on the rabbit plane, you know. You come back and you speak in the rabbit language about your experiences. That's what we do now. You know, we use concepts. And they inform each other. Yeah. What you come back with informs your way of looking. It informs your perceptions. It informs your intentions. It informs your self-construct. It informs your notion of how you relate and how you are connected to others. But I think for this to happen, we need to leave the plane of discursive thinking. There is no doubt in my mind about this.
Are you talking mainly about formal practicing, like sitting and having meditation, or even about daily stuff?
Right now I've spoken of formal practice. Yeah. Well, there are interesting other fields, you know. Maybe you know focusing. Focusing is an ingenious approach, yeah. In terms of meditation, focusing is very superficial. It doesn't go deep. So meditators sometimes turn their noses towards focusing because they, well, it's not real proper samadhi, you know. It's still, you know, you still have thoughts and images and this kind of thing, so it can't be. But focusing does very brilliant stuff. You just kind of go below the discursive mind. You don't try to be very still. In fact, you try to... You cultivate a type of awareness that allows you to be at the threshold, yeah, where meaning emerges, so where cognitive activity starts. But it is very, very low level. Yeah. It's very emergent. It's very threshold stuff. It's liminal. So, and you stay there. And you cultivate an awareness that actually lives there. And you find profound connections that you couldn't find in meditation, and that you couldn't find in thinking either. But because you've learned to make your mind still and to direct attention to particular somatic processes and states, but not just physical sensation, it's not just kaya nupassana, you've actually found a layer where very meaningful things occur. And this is very useful. It's useful for the meditator, because he knows a lot more about his body, and it's useful for the non-meditator, because it helps you make decisions and understand things in your life. Yeah? So these things are not black and white as I described them. I described them more black and white so that you recognize things. Because this morning I was going to speak about the pathology of mindfulness, or to stop the things how mindfulness can be captured or sidetracked or lost. Yeah. Good.
Maybe this discussion reminds me that what is you did yesterday. Look at the I concept for the Buddhism.
Yeah.
And that what easier to ask to accept it? Someone give us food or give us room or give us discourse. It's easier to accept the connectedness of us.
Yeah.
And when it comes to the generosity to share our feelings, our thought, all the things we see, it's more personal, more eye, yep. So it makes more tense.
Yeah, so the density of personalizing experience, you mean the identification with...
The sharing, what we call personal life, it makes it more tense, more anxiety to share this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's true. I sometimes think it's a kind of like, you know, pyramid shape. And you have pyramids, you know, you have pyramids standing by side by side. They touch at the base, yeah. But the egoic part of the pyramid is the tip. Yeah, and between the tips you have the greatest distance. Yeah, but actually at the base they're all touching. You know, as long as I'm identified with the top post, you know, the next one is way over there. Yeah, but actually if I sink deeper in my being, actually we touch base. You know, we're in fact we're connected. Yeah, but only if I'm not into my egoic self construct. The more I'm up in there, the less I'm actually feeling connected. So the more this poor self-construct is in need of validation, you know. It needs approval, it needs recognition. It's very needy, you know. Good, let me quickly switch over. Same topic, but a different perspective. I have written down a couple of ways how sati can be challenged, yeah? Can I hang that behind you? You don't take that personal, do you know? Good. So how can sati be challenged? How could it feel when we're actually losing sati? Let's talk psychology. One way we can be caught. Yeah. When our sati is losing its dexterity, its mobility, its fluency. Yeah. So sati is fixated. Yeah?
Sorry to bother, but you started the last session with saying something about the hindrances are thoughts, mainly.
Not
three and a half of them.
Yeah.
Can you, you know, connect?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, 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 yeah. Well, you see, the hindrances are specifically Buddhist way of looking at what can happen to mindfulness. It can be preoccupied by desire, it can be preoccupied by ill will, by sleepiness, by doubt, by restlessness, by agitation. If you sit with people, and if you sit particularly with yourself, I trust that you are your own patients, yeah? And I don't believe in any sort of therapy that doesn't do what it preaches to itself, yeah? So I assume that we're looking eye to eye on this. I'm not teaching stuff you do to others, I'm teaching stuff you primarily do to yourself. And when you have done it to yourself, you will be able to share this with others and you will be able to help others. So, but speaking in psychological terms, the one thing that can happen to our sati is it gets snagged, yeah? It gets hijacked by a particular aspect of our experience. We fixate, yeah? So we're walking into the room, we're having a quick conversation, and in that quick conversation, somebody insults us. We have a hurt, yeah? And we sit in that room, 2 hours later, we're still with that conversation, we're still with that hurt. As the result of this conversation, there's a fascinating lecture going on, but unfortunately, our mind keeps going back to that, you know, how she looked when she said that. It wasn't just what she said, but it's just how she really enjoyed, you know, hurting me or something like that. Yeah. So our attention is preoccupied, is captured, is hijacked by a particular aspect of our experience, either pleasurable, often enough painful or disturbing or frightening. Frightening aspects. If you speak with people with phobias, it's very obvious. Yeah. Have you heard one of the great things about mindfulness? This is what we learned from the newspapers. Mindfulness is very good against autobiographic rumination. Translation in Hebrew? Ruminating is what cows do, you know. They kind of eat and then they regurgitate. That's rumination technically.
מה?
I think it's good that you get that clear in Hebrew. Yeah. You know, think of the cow. The cow eats grass, and it now has many stomachs. I forgot how many, 6 maybe. So it doesn't digest straight away. What it does, it eats and it stores. And then after a while, when it doesn't eat grass anymore, you see cow stands there and it still chews, although it doesn't eat anymore. Yeah? It means it takes food from one part of its stomach and it comes back up and then it chews and then it puts it into another stomach. Okay? This process is of bringing things you already have in your stomach, bringing it back up and continuing to chew on it. This process is called rumination. Yeah? Yes, exactly. Regurgitation. Yeah. Or ruminating is the mental concept derived from it. Yeah.
So in this aspect, ruminating is like in a negative aspect?
Yes.
Of course.
Entirely negative. Since you're not a cow. Yeah. You eat once, that's good. Your stomach takes care of this. You know, it goes down the esophagus and then the digestive juice is treated and so forth. Yeah? So you don't need to do that. But our mind does that a lot of the time. Yeah.
It's kind of the main symptom of depression and anxiety.
Right. It's one of the main ingredients of depression. If you have a real full-blown depression, you think basically 3 thoughts, you know. I'm not happy. I was never happy. I can never be happy. Yeah. And you keep repeating them, sort of mantra type, yeah. I mean, this is simplified. There are many reasons for depression, but it's one of the things that if you want to look at the cognitive aspect of depression, you know, you could also look at your liver metabolism or something, but cognitive aspect of depression is autobiographical rumination. Keep regurgitating the same thoughts, generally unhappy thoughts, and not very clever, not very creative. Repetition. It's a sort of carousel.
You know.
Yeah. Yes, carousel with a spiral spin, yes. So mindfulness is one way of stopping this. That's why mindfulness is very useful for depressed people. So, in terms of my little list here, this is about losing fluency. Mindfulness gets preoccupied by one particular aspect of my experience. In this case, autobiographical rumination. And all the other things are not receiving my attention. Sometimes if mindfulness is lost, we are losing our sense of here and now. Yeah. We can lose our sense of here and now basically by thinking. We are capable of moving away from here and now where the body is with the help of our head. Yeah. That is a powerful possibility. This is both a resource and it is a danger. Yeah. Most of the time it is a danger. It can be an inspiration. Yeah. The other day this Austrian girl who was kidnapped and captured at age, God knows, 6, and locked up for the next, 10 years or so. 8 years, I forgot how long it was, Natasha Kampusch. And probably abused by some crazy guy who locked her up in the basement.
Her grandfather, no?
No, this was another guy. There's a few guys out there. This one locked up a whole family. But the one I mean was a stranger. He was a neighbor. He kidnapped her off the road. And he lived in the neighborhood of her parents. And he locked her up. And she came out 2 years ago. Gone public, very public. And she described how after 2 years of her captivity, and she was, I think, 8 years old at that stage, or 10 years old, she realized that she was stronger than the guy who was her captured. Yeah. She realized that she was stronger than that, and she realized that one day she would come out. Yeah. And that thought has given her tremendous power. So this is a thought completely, you know, her here and now was horrible. It was a hole in the ground, 2 doors. She was shut off, dreadful. Yeah. So her here and now experience gave no rise to hope whatsoever. But that thought of feeling that she has power and that she will one day come out here because she sensed to be stronger than this person who captivated her, gave her tremendous power. So this would be a very positive way of using the mind's capacity to think. Yeah? Jewish tradition is full of that. Oh my God, you must know this, you know. Longing for Zion, you know, the Holy Land, you know, kind of throughout the centuries, or the Messiah, you know, this is big.
Yeah. It's very bad. It's very good to get out of from here and now. But since we are here and we are in a great physical situation, so it's very good for us to be in here and now.
Definitely. You see, going away from here and now can give us a mental strength. It can give us hope. It can give us inspiration. But to be doing something where we are, we need to be where we are. Not just with our bodies, but with our hearts, with our heads, with our attention. Because the place here and the place now is the only place you can be happy. It's the only place you can be free. It's the only place you can truly learn something. It's the only place you can truly understand something. It's the only place you can be compassionate. Yeah? It's the only place you can enjoy. So there's good reasons to be here and now. In terms of spiritual development, being here and now is the only place where you can actually transform something. So if you learn to go away to get strength from going away, it only is useful if you come and bring that strength back here. Yeah. But obviously the psyche has defense functions. You know, it knows how to cope with difficult situations. So going away, if you want a psychological take, and this is dissociation. Yeah. If you're very small and you're very helpless and you're very sensitive, you know, your first defense mechanism is dissociative. You know, you hold your breath. By holding your breath, you feel less. Yeah. And later on, when you have more cognitive activity, you learn to fantasize yourself away, to feel less. Yeah. So that's what we keep doing. Unfortunately, we not just save that measure for emergency situations, we keep doing it all the time. You know, we keep being in one situation and we think about being in the next situation. We were joking, we were on the last retreat, the Sandhya and Patel both had seen the same cartoon I have seen years ago in a German magazine. It says, basically, it showed a woman cooking. And while cooking, she was kind of thinking of being with the kid. Yeah. And then she was with the kid. She was thinking of hoovering. Yeah. And then she was hoovering. And then she was thinking of being in bed with her husband. And then she was in bed with her husband. She was thinking of the cooking again. Yeah? So this is our situation. This is called dissociation in real life. We're not just doing it in emergency situations where we don't have the physical power to be aggressive, where the only way to minimize the pain in our experience is to go away internally, yeah, to pull in the energy and pull it up. Yeah, this is what dissociation does. It goes in and out. And we do that habitually with thought because we think thought is so important. And by going away, we give up the possibilities we have changing life here. Enjoying, understanding, connecting, acting, transforming. All this goes away if we live out there, somewhere else, sometime, some other time. So that's why this is a problem. Losing here and now is what we habitually do with dreaming, fantasizing, remembering, planning. Yeah, this is all forms of losing the here and now. You can find that in meditation. You can find that in therapy. You can find that sitting with your partner at breakfast and you're basically already somewhere else. Yeah. We all know how that feels when it happens to us. We all know how that feels when others do it to us. You know, it's people sitting in meetings suddenly beginning to fiddle with their iPhones or Blackberries or doodling or you know, or getting awakened there, and you realize now they're doing holiday planning rather than attending to agenda points. Yeah.
I think as therapists, so people who work with people, is a very good thing to notice when we are with a client or patient, and sometimes we feel bored, or we feel, oh yeah, she's saying the same thing she's been saying, you know, all the meetings, etc. And something in us disconnects or bored or goes away and, well, you know, does a shopping list. And what you suggested earlier with the hindrances, and that is getting to know boredom, for instance, or checking what it is that got me disconnected. What was that the half a second before I had the urge to disconnect, to bring attention or awareness there?
Grateful for this, Sandhya, thank you. Boredom, very crucial ingredient of dissociation, you know. Often what makes us dissociate are not traumatic influences, it's we're bored, you know. Our interest, remember interest as being one of the first things of mindfulness, our interest goes. You know. And with the interest going, our attention turns to something more gratifying than where we are right now. Yeah, or something we believe is more pressing. Yeah. So interest goes, boredom comes up, and then we disconnect. We go away to some nice place or some painful place or, you know, some anxious place, depending on how our temperaments are. If you're an anxious type, you will always go to something that creates anxiety or holds risk. If you're a desire type, you will go to something pleasant. If you're an anger type, you will go to something that gives you the nice stimulation and vitalization of getting annoyed, indignant, angry about something. You get a lot of energy out of being angry. So, but in all three cases, the reason for disconnecting was actually loss of interest, loss of touching the other. Yeah. That's what happens in your own meditation. Much of what happens in your own meditation you can see echoed in your therapy rooms. Yeah. And as Sandhya said, the best way to deal with this is acknowledging that it happens. Yeah. I am bored. Do I know how I am when I am bored? Yeah. Do you know how you are? How do you feel when you're bored? Do you know how your body feels when you're bored? Do you know what your mind does when it is disinterested in a situation. This is good to know as meditators and a therapist. Do you know where you go to when you're bored and disconnect? Are you more kind of fantasizing about nice things, or are you more getting annoyed about not so nice things, or what are you doing? Are you more anxious thinking of things you haven't done and you should do, and you're not sure whether you have time to do them? What kind of is your tendency? What sort of diagnosis do you give yourself on that one? It's good to know one's type, not in terms of diagnosis, but in terms of just strategies rather than structure. Yeah. Yeah, please.
I want to say something about
boredom.
Yeah. Teachers, my students say I'm boring. I say, if you have we have the head on our shoulder, how we can be bored? There's some things to think about and to plan and.
Well, it's generally, you know, boredom for me. Has to do with attention. You know, if I hear somebody is bored, I'm basically saying they're not interested. There's not enough attention. But that only explains half of it. Because this, at any one time, is so much happening in our lives. Yeah. Even if you sit still for a whole day, there's so much happening. If you pay attention, if you bother to pay attention, that, you know, there's lots of things happening. There's no reason for boredom. Even if you're absolutely on your own for a whole day, sitting still. There's so many things are going on simultaneously that there's no objective reason for boredom. But generally, boredom says something else. Boredom says, I expect to be gratified on that level, and what is happening is only happening at that level of intensity. Yeah. So this is not enough. This little is not enough for my intention to come out, you know. I expect to be seduced at a more high level of intensity. Now that's very much what in habituated attention does. It expects seduction, you know, and it expects the promise for gratification. So if that promise for gratification is not fulfilled, then it just goes to sleep or it gets bored. Rather than adjusting to the threshold of stimulation that is present, it's kind of sulking, you know. What is that in Hebrew? It's kind of, you know, it does this kind of thing, yeah? It sulks. It says, I'm not getting what I want here, so I'm going bored, you know. I'm getting a little restless or bored, or I dissociate, you know.
So it's expectations, basically?
I think a huge chunk in boredom, when I speak with people, is their expectations, generally unacknowledged expectations. Yes, please, you want to say something. Contentment or containment?
Containment.
Yeah, as in Bayan containment.
As in lachil,
container.
As a container.
Yeah.
I think when you speak about difficulty to touch deeper layers in therapy and also in meditation, it's not only expectation on this level, it's a difficulty to sit and contain.
Yeah.
Difficult stuff. Yeah? So, and I think mindfulness is to develop this ability to contain, to be with.
Good point, but I don't see the connection to boredom right now.
It is because sometimes it goes like on the surface, it comes like boredom. Boredom, numbness.
Okay.
Yeah. But really, it's just a difficulty to be in touch.
Yeah.
With
yeah.
Deeper layers, with life as it is. Sometimes just that, it's too much. It's too painful. It's just too intense.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying mindfulness strengthens your capacity to both be more prolonged in relationship with things you may not like, and to help you contain. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, to help you contain the parts you don't like in order to, or it's not just they don't like, you like, but it's too something, too intense, too painful, too extreme, too
Definitely.
Frightening.
Definitely. I would use the term containment generally for intensity, usually intensity of things that are expansive, yeah? So things that want to go out. Contained, I would use the term containment to hold in, yeah? Rather than, say, to be in touch with something. But it's a very important term, creating a container for difficult things. And because we can contain them, we can allow them to change in mindfulness. Yeah. Thank you. Your neighbor?
I was wondering what you think about this sentence that I'm going to say, that I'm not sure what I think about. So I'm interested to hear what you think. That is, I just remember I heard it somewhere that maybe boredom is when you meet your own emptiness, but it freaks you out. So then you have to run somewhere else. And if it has some grains of truth in it, then I guess it's like being as close and in the same time as far from one of our goals while meditating.
Mm-hmm. I could imagine that boredom is a response to meeting one's own emptiness, but I don't think it is just that, you know. I think sometimes boredom is just, I had expectations here and it came here and I just feel it doesn't deserve my precious attention, you know. You know, I'm too good for this, basically. So I'm splitting off with my attention somewhere else where I have more interesting things to think than to listen to you, you know, kind of thing, yeah. It's a combination of expectation and also of conceit, yeah. Whatever that would be in, yeah. Yeah. Well, I guess it has something to do. Well, it can have something to do with, you know, your memory of your own childhood, which may be more embellished now than it was, because it means because you don't remember the boredom, you only remember the good bits. So when you think of your childhood, the good bits stand out more. But I suspect you're right. That because kids probably have more stimuli today, they strangely also have more boredom because they expect stimulation.
Maybe we have to wait 15 years and then to ask them how was their childhood.
Well, we could do that, but I'm more interested in another line of thought, which says, you know, if gratification comes from intensity of stimulus, then we have a growing scale, isn't it? Mm-hmm. If I'm gratified, in other words, if I give my attention to things that gratify me and I am used to a certain intensity, for the same amount of gratification, I need more intensity because I get used to things. Yeah. That's one of the things that has to do with dukkha. Yeah. I was hoping to say something about this afternoon. We get habituated to a certain intensity of stimulus. At the beginning it was great, and then we get a little bored with it, and then we need to intensify the stimulation, yeah, so that we can have the same gratification. In other words, we need keep needing more to have the same subjective gratification experience. Yeah, or many things. It doesn't have to be illegal, you know.
Actually, our society built on this. It's very legal, but it's very good.
Yes. Most societies are built on this. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Most societies are built on this. Yeah.
Which means we're heading towards disaster, because at some point, there's too many stimulations in order.
Well, look at our societies. I don't know. You have your own opinions about yours. I'm not very familiar with yours, but I see enough trouble as far as I can see. And the societies I grew up in, or I lived in, they have plenty of trouble. You know, if you have individual greed as the motor of your basic well. Of your affluence in a country, then you at the same time have frustration because not everybody is able to fulfill the greed, so these people will become very angry. That explains some of the violence. That explains some of the depression. You know, I grew up in a country where people are supposedly rich. I never thought they were particularly rich when I grew up. They didn't strike me as very rich. But considered with other societies, Switzerland is rich. But you have very high child suicide rate, you have very high drug consumption rate, you have very high depression rate, you have very high consumption of antidepressants and, you know, mood enhancers. And there's a lot of indications that tell me that this is not a happy society. So you can do that with Finland, where they will probably take less antidepressants and more alcohol, or, you know. But then you can go to America, you're going to England, and I'm sure Israel has its own particular brand of the same suffering, basically. Yeah. I speak with many people about Israel, and many of them speak to me in grief. Yeah. In grief about the country, about the vision that was in this country, you know, a few 60 years ago, and you know, many people feel grief. That's what I pick up, and helplessness.
About Israelis or foreigners?
About the lot, you know, the complexity of it. And you will find in every society, you know, you say we are all in trouble. I think we are in trouble, you know. And that's one of the reasons why you're probably here, because you sense some of that trouble. And that's also the reason why what we do is not very popular, you know, because most people will prefer to stay with the problem than to seek for a solution that is not comfortable, or that doesn't look comfortable, or that looks difficult, or that looks as if it goes against the grain. Yeah. That's why not more people are meditating. You know, it's cheap. You can do it anywhere. You don't need special equipment, you know. It has better press than it has ever had, you know. It is making inroads into popular psychology now. So why are not more people meditating?
Well, it's becoming more and more popular.
Yeah, but it's still, you know, it's still not very popular.
It's evolving everywhere.
A lot of people do more, say, cycling or smoking or going to church. You know, there's lots more people doing that, you know, if you compare, yeah. Yeah, because it's difficult, and it makes you insecure, because it some things in your side are not safe. Yeah, you feel all too aware that you don't understand everything that's going on, and you're dependent on things you can't control, and there may be things you're afraid of, and you have no guarantees. A Akinjana doesn't give a money back guarantee, you know, after 4 days of. So, you know, there's.
But as a really something that happened, that if we compare how many people meditate 30 years ago, we can see that there's it's growing in thousands of percent, and it's not only the fact that there's some that meditate, but some other that take responsibility about their life by doing yoga practice, and some other by grow organic, and some other by changing other habits, or do psychotherapy, or bringing East and West together, or traveling around the world. It's do create some kind of a very huge subculture that's still the big communication.
I share your enthusiasm. I don't share your hope. I'm all too conscious that our oceans are getting dirtier, our animals are disappearing, our ice caps are melting, our forests are going, that are more people are hungry than 30 years ago, that the wealth is more unequally distributed. I share, I am part of that movement. I am, you know, I know this, but I am also conscious that while we do this, while more people do this, bad things are happening as well. I don't believe in a collective awakening. You know, awakening of that sort I'm interested in seems to be happening on a personal basis. It seems to be happening because individual people take responsibility and they are willing to make difficult decisions and confront threatening perspectives. They do that only individually. I know no institution, monasteries included, who actually convincingly do that, to be honest with you. So I'm very clear that individual responsibility is at the center of growth. And if obviously you have a number of individuals who do that around you, you know, your immediate surroundings look better. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I don't believe that any institution or any large body can actually claim an evolutionary progress.
And what if many individuals do it, which we see that it's happened, we don't know about the future, you know?
That's what I keep hoping.
Yeah, so it's the same, it's just a movement which is based on individual and not on ideology.
Yes.
That's why it's hard for us to digest it. And we can also see it as kind of even as the immune system of the humanity itself. Rise up and say, oh, something here is wrong. We try to wake up. I see the suffering. I feel it personally about this planet very much.
I'm conscious of this.
It's a
very inspiring thought. Us as the immune system of the planet, you mean? Meditators as the early warning systems of the great sickness. Yeah, if this helps you, if this makes you more inspired, I'm trying to be more therapeutic with my own patient, you know, and hold vision for happiness, hold vision for freedom, hold vision for awakening. And on some days it feels I'm doing a better job than on other days. And being mindful makes that more possible.
Yeah, but without creating a new society, and that's something, one of the reasons why I'm not dealing with therapy right now, it seems like we only help to the people that society fucked up, sorry for this word, and rather than create an alternative society which can, you know, be mindful, or be alternative, or be ecological, or be social justice, or be self-fulfilling. And in this term, sometimes that's why as a therapist is so hard, because we meet all of the difficulties, and it feels like one drop in an ocean, and we deal with these drops rather than saying, maybe we should create something new from a beginning. And that's in a way why I also very much believe in Tovana, because it's create a culture, and not only a therapy.
I hear you. It's just, you know, start from the beginning. What does that mean? You know, what does that mean? If only we could do that. You know, I started not trying to do what my parents do. I wanted to start at the beginning. It's so difficult to start at the beginning, isn't it? Because we don't actually start at the beginning. We already have a lot of weight. Yeah. So I did a few of those starts, trying to create a new human being. Yeah. I had my fling with politics, and I had my fling with alternative societies, and I had my fling with monastic visions of creating a new human being. I can't really believe that we can be start at the beginning. I think we need to take a long, hard look at what we bring along. Sober, not drunk with hope, courageous, and be clear what we bring along. Because every new beginning carries already the stuff we carry, we don't dare looking at, we're not acknowledging, you know. Every new beginning I started had a shadow of things that I didn't know before. Yeah. And I believe myself to be confirmed. I'm aware this is a total digression here. I believe myself to be confirmed by a look into history that those moments when human beings claimed most fervently a new beginning, that they were very close to generally committing some atrocities. Very close. The more serious they were about eradicating the old and starting completely anew, They were generally very, very close to doing some big time damage.
Mm-hmm. And that's when you spoke about the ideology, but when you spoke about individual, a community of individuals that wakes up, it's a whole different story. And that was never happened in history, so you maybe at the Buddha time.
Actually, I was born on a kibbutz. The attempt was to create a new person. A new human being in a new different kind of society we all know. Where are we at?
Yeah, I'm sure you do.
But it sounds like a Mahayana approach towards awakening of everybody.
Look, I believe in community. I've spent the largest part of my adult life in monastic communities, and before that I've lived in other communities. I enjoy communities. I wouldn't do what I do if I wasn't enjoying this and having some hope in this. But it needs to be a community of individuals that are mature and self-responsible and willing to look at their own stuff. I'm utterly fed up with communities who try not to look at their own stuff and who try to create something that consists of a vision without actually an acknowledgement of what they bring along. So I have no hope for such communities. Personally, and a look in history leaves me with little hope. The problem is ignorance. And that ignorance has many faces. On one level, it is a lack of sensitivity, a lack of acknowledgement of connectedness, a lack of sometimes simply a lack of fantasy, you know, that things could be different than they are. And if communities grow, they grow for mature individuals, and if communities grow for other reasons, I'm not interested in them. You know, fascism was a very convincing community for some people in those days. You know, it held a lot of sway. The mafia started as a self-help organization. You know, there are many communities gone wrong. I am deeply concerned about degrees of unconsciousness. And the most dangerous forms of unconsciousness are collective forms of unconsciousness, fear-based collective forms of unconsciousness. So I see there is no way past individual responsibility, and that means learning to be the owner of my experience. Learning to cultivate happiness with this heart, patience with this heart, investigation into this heart, stillness in this heart, harmony in these differing, clashing aspects of my psyche. If people join in, you know, I'm all too happy. I would love to be infectious with this. Yeah, but I cannot wait for communities to happen. I do not wait, and I do not believe that communities are better than the individuals in those communities. I do not believe that communities make people more responsible or more sensitive. I do think growth happens inside out and not outside in. So that's why I meditate rather than do politics. I believe we're not so far apart from what I hear you say. I just want to make my point clear that the community that does not consist of mature, inspired, self-responsible individuals that are willing to hold their own conflicts will be a community that will deal very badly with its conflicts. Yeah? Mm-hmm. I know so many communities full of well-intended people with huge problems. Yeah, because precisely of that. Because they try to do something together they have not learned to do on their own. Yeah. And I just fail to be enthusiastic about, you know, global evolution or collective awakening or things like that. I do think it starts very much with owning up, learning to be with what I create in this world, learning to take responsibility for the powers in my heart and for the hang-ups of this heart. Yeah. And if you make friends along the way, this is fantastic. Yeah. This is what I would wish. This is what I hope to, in some way, be part of. But nobody will take the part that I have to do away. Nobody's atvas will awaken me. Yeah. So, I hope this is an answer. Yeah. I'm conscious also that we have slightly digressed from the pathology of mindfulness. Let me add the three last ones, and then we definitely need a break. One thing that can happen to my mindfulness, I can lose the space. Yeah? I can collapse in my field of attention to a single aspect of my experience. Rather than holding the space of my experience, I can collapse to a single aspect. Yeah? So I get locked, knotted into something. This is the thing that really hits me. Yeah. There's this one characteristic of a situation that really preoccupies me. I don't see the rest. All I see is, you know, the spots on the wall. Yeah. Come in here. You know, I really have bad karma, obviously. Everywhere I go, there are spots on the wall. Yeah. So my bad karma. I travel around the world, I meet nice people, and all I get is walls that are, you know, paint is flaking off. Yeah. I'm living a sad and sordid life, you know, I've given my best and all they get is, you know, spotty walls wherever I go. It haunts me, it's the bane of my life. You know. I remember as a little child I was lying sick under the blanket and looking at the ceiling and what did I see? Spots. Yeah. I'm 51 years old and still, you know, where every wall I look at, spots. Yeah. This is losing the space. Yeah. This is obsessive kind of type, yeah. Obsessive kind of pattern. There are many other walls, but I see the spot. Yeah. Losing the space also may mean sometimes with people, yeah. A kind of, we have an open inquiry and then we get locked into something. Yeah. Sometimes this is what we want. If we have people who are oppositional in strategy, say in your therapy sessions or so, people who are always in the no mode, yeah. No. Law. People who are laws. Yeah. Yeah. You say something, they always say the opposite. So there are people who seek as a meaningful way of connection conflict. Yeah. Some people only feel connection when they have conflict. Yeah. Adversity. You will have met such people. So the only way you can actually connect with them is they seek to either tease you, or they seek to provoke you, or they seek to contradict you, or yeah. So their only way of actually connecting is in some way conflictive or hard. And it's very difficult to not collapse onto that conflict. Yeah. It's very difficult to not retaliate in the same way. It's very difficult to keep the space open and not feel provoked. So mindfulness can be, you know, it can lose the space dramatically. In terms of interaction, that means a lot changes in a one-to-one. But this can happen to my own meditation experience. I can have a particular pain, and my whole meditation consists of dealing with that pain. It seems that this pain is my whole experience. So I get in some ways, you know, this may be meaningful and useful and necessary that I deal with this experience, but I somehow allow that my mindfulness reduces in size to the size of the problem. Pain is a particularly good one for that. Yeah? You have a little knee pain, your meditation is peaceful and quiet, you're spacious and open, this kind of little knee pain comes in. Yeah? And suddenly, you know, all your meditation seems to be about this knee pain. It takes away the space of the rest. You know, there are still sounds and feelings and breath and gentleness in your heart, but somehow the knee pain seems to be the major feature of your experience. So loss of space. Losing embodiment, that's an important one. Losing embodiment means we leave the place where the body actually is a sentient organism. We become a head. We become a set of ideas. We become just witnesses. You know? We stop actually feeling what our heart feels, where our weight goes, what our legs feel like. We stop sensing the size of our bodies. We stop sensing the energy in these bodies. We leave the body. Yeah? The associative process. Meditators are particularly prone to that, just to be clear. Yeah? Many meditators have a psychological disposition to dissociation. That's why they're here in the first place. That's why they think they can get here. But one shouldn't always give people what they wish to get. Yeah? So generally, meditators are people who are good at dissociating. They're good at... they have a high awareness of their mental and inner lives. So many people who you see in monasteries or in meditation centers or in meditation retreats are people who are more likely than your average selection of people on the road to be using dissociative strategies. How would be dissociation in Hebrew? So one of the things that you notice when you dissociate is you lose your body. You go somewhere in your head. You go away, you stop feeling what your body actually feels. Your sensory awareness disappears. Your embodiment feels. That means also your affective awareness goes, because you experience affect, not just with... these are not just disconnected emotions somewhere in your neocortex. They have something to do with your heart. And if you lose your body, you will lose connection with other people. If you lose your own body, you tend to lose an affective and particularly an empathetic connection with other people. Because this is a very bad thing, both for meditators and for therapists. The last thing you want is a therapist who is disembodied. Yeah. It's out there. Models for you how to live a dissociated life. Yeah. Catastrophe. So, it's important to know when this is happening. What are the telltale signs? Dissociation is a very difficult challenge for meditators because, you know, if you're greedy or if you're angry, if you're enough greedy and enough angry, your mind will tell you, yeah? Enough greedy, your eyes will come out, yeah? You will have Stielaugen, yeah? You will have kind of... You start salivating, your tongue hangs out, yeah? If you're greedy enough. If you're enough angry, you know, your knuckles go white. Yeah. Again, your eyes this time will be red. Yeah. Your circulation will change. Your breath will change. So if you're angry or if you're greedy, after a certain intensity, everybody knows. Yeah. Not even you know. Yeah. With dissociation, it's not so easy. You can be very gently, gradually disappearing here from your body without noticing. You don't have any clear signs. And the further out you go, the more difficult it is to actually know. Yeah. In terms of Buddhist teachings, this is connected with ignorance. Losing embodiment is connected with ignorance. And everything connected with ignorance is more difficult to recognize. Because ignorance doesn't come with a big sign around its neck saying, "I'm called ignorance." Yeah. Ignorance sometimes can be very, very plausible. It can be speaking very clear, apparently clear. So, going away from your immediate experience, it means makes you more likely for burnout, it makes you more likely for overweight, it makes you more likely for, arteriosclerosis. You know, you have a lot of better chances for illnesses if you do strategic disembodiment. Not feeling your body, not living in your body, not sensing your body, not paying attention to your body, not learning how to inhabit your body is unhealthy, really. Not just for other people when you're a therapist, but is unhealthy for yourself.
It can happen in meditation. I don't understand. It can happen in meditation, such a thing?
Yes.
No,
it's not particularly, it doesn't have to be particularly high. Generally, it It takes just a little bit of decision in your heart to not feel what you feel, and that's enough for dissociation. And if you keep doing that, then you dissociate. Yeah. Your unwillingness to feel what you feel in the body, for example, your lack of skill to actually feel the body, your fear of feeling what you feel, this is plenty to be dissociating. This gives you a very good start as a dissociator. You don't need to have a high meditative attainment. High meditative attainments are not about dissociating, contrary. They're about being more here rather than being more out there. It's an attitude that decides upon this. It's not a meditative problem. It's a life problem. Many people are dissociated. You know? There are many things that help you dissociate. Spending 10 hours behind a computer, for example, help you dissociate a lot. Being focused on ideas and visual experience helps you dissociate a lot. Not doing any sort of body work helps you dissociate a lot. There's plenty of ways you can dissociate. You know? So disembodiment means your attention, your mindfulness has gone away from the body. You have noticed every meditation tradition speaks about coming back to the body, because the body is the only place you can be sure that you are here and that the time is now. Your emotions, they can be having as a topic something that has happened 30 years ago. Your thoughts, that they can deal with things that will never happen, but that you just keep thinking will happen. Even your pleasure is no guarantee that it is happening now. The only thing that is a guarantee that it takes place now and that your mindfulness is connected to present tense is body. Because whenever you feel the body, you feel the body now. You don't feel yesterday's bodies or you don't feel tomorrow's body. Yeah? You can only feel a body as it is now. So every meditation tradition, Tibetan, Japanese, Korean, Thai, understands you need to start with the body. That's in terms of Satipatthana, where are they? In terms of these four different perspectives on experience, we always start with kaya, with channel one. Yeah? Body, learning to connect mindfulness with the body. Good. Finally, last point. Losing the other, which means my mindfulness is internalized. My mindfulness collapses on my subjective experience. And you fall away. This is the narcissist perspective. Yeah. Or if you want the perverted Indian understanding of this, you are simply modulations of my consciousness. You don't really exist, people. You're basically just modulations of my own consciousness. So you don't have any genuine separate validity. This is just one big dream, and you happen to be part of my dream. Yeah? So your pain doesn't really count. Your needs don't really count. Your opinions don't really count. It's nice of you to be part of my dream, but please behave according to my dream. And if you don't behave according to my dream, you're getting kicked out. Yeah. So losing the other means something in my awareness, in my attention, collapses to the inside. I'm preoccupied with my needs, my thoughts, my feelings, my experiences, my anxieties. And I need to control the world, basically, so that this is taken care of. Because this is the important part. Yeah? Or maybe more simply, we talk casually and then you say something and then I just kind of follow my association because it has triggered a memory. Yeah? And apparently our conversation continues, but I'm no longer here. You know, I am here, but you are no longer here, basically. Because I continue the conversation in my head. Yeah? And suddenly I'm with my childhood memory of the first guava I have ever eaten or so. And right now, because you've said guava, I'm, you know, back in my first Thai holidays when I was little and playing at the beach, and some nice old Thai man came and gave me a fresh guava, something like that. Yeah? And you keep telling me whatever you tell me, and I'm there right back on that beach, 4 years old, eating my first guava. And what you say is just a blur to me. Yeah? So I lose the other. Sometimes in our attention, that can happen. Dramatically with pain, again. All of these happen with different things, yeah? Sometimes losing fluency can happen with desire, you know? With the effect of, say, sexual desire, I may suddenly, you know, be preoccupied with my interest in sexuality or in erotic stimulation, and I may, you know, turn you into an object, you know? You stop being a human being for me, but you suddenly become an object of my sexual desire. Yeah? This would be a fixation on one aspect of life, which is called sexuality. And for some reason, you hold that for me right now. And my insistence that this is the interesting part right now in our experience, in our shared experience, may make you a thing, yeah? May make you an object. Yeah? I'm not hearing what you're telling me. I not hear what you wish. I don't empathize with what's happening in your life. All I see is that you may be sexually attractive to me. Yeah? These are very simple examples of losing fluency. Yeah? Fear does a lot of that. You know, we're sitting here and somebody tells, well, there's lots of Scorpios here in Endor, you know. Not just the nice black ones, actually the nasty white ones, you know, the really dangerous ones. Yeah? And suddenly you begin to stop listening to what he says and you start looking at, you know, where could they come from or where, you know, get the legs up, you know, this kind of thing. So you lose your fluency in awareness. Suddenly the space becomes smaller. You're vigilant, but, you know, very topically vigilant. Your accessibility for the rest of the story is gone. Yeah. Losing the here and now means you fantasize, you dream of, or you remember, or you go into sort of a grieving circle. Yeah. Something says something, you know, and this is a powerful story, and the powerful inner story begins, and you're lost. You know, you keep standing there, and traffic is going left and right, and you're lost in your thought. This is very much losing the here and now. Losing the space has something to do with the size of your field awareness, your capacity to hold space in awareness. You know, happens a lot. This can happen because of desire, because of anxiety, because of anger. Anger is probably the most profound, you know. Suddenly, the whole life of somebody else collapses to one aspect, you know, and she starts looking like a caricature. You know? And you really find the expression she has right now is unpleasant, and you hate it, or you're indignant. So the space, you know, the whole life of this person is gone. You know, right now she's just always trying to make your life miserable. Generally, this happens with people we love. Yeah. So we only get really angry and really hateful with people we love. You know, it's something we spare for the ones we are most close to. So suddenly, that you have lived with this person for 20 years is forgotten. All you see is she always leaves her breadcrumbs on the table when you come. Yeah? And this aspect makes you lose the space. Space of what good things she does or what else. You just kind of lost the space.
Could you clarify for me the difference between losing a fluency and losing the space? It seems that it's similar. I'm not sure I get that.
Well,
I can really distinguish
it. Losing the fluency generally means that you have no, your attention is blocked. Okay. Yeah? So there are many things happening and which you could attend to, which in fact to survive you need to attend to, and somehow you are blocked, either by desire, by fear, by hurt, yeah, okay. Or by anger. With losing the space, this is more if you think of the panoramic quality of mindfulness. It's still may be mobile, but it has dwindled in size. Yeah, the field of your awareness has dramatically receded. Yeah? That's a difference. Losing embodiment, I think, is clear, and losing the other is also clear. We, you know, I just give that a little note there, but obviously this is big. Losing the other is very big. We contract to our self-construct. We contract to our notion of this is where the world happens. You know, this is the important bit. We stop acknowledging connectedness. We stop being empathetic. We stop using our capacity to be attentive for others. Yeah. Sometimes you will meet people who tell you that they're very, very sensitive. Yeah. But they're only sensitive to their own feelings. You know? So this type of sensitivity is in loss of the other.
So why do so many meditators go and live in caves, for example?
There aren't many meditators living in caves.
Yeah.
This is a myth.
But there are some. I'm trying to practice mindfulness.
Why?
But you're saying they're actually losing the touch of being with others.
I think, first of all, where did you get that from, that many meditators are living
I'm
in caves?
I'm just reading the Tanzanian Flame of a book.
Yeah.
She lived 12 years in the...
Yeah.
12.
Tanzanian
Flame.
Tanzanian Palmo. Well, not many meditators live in caves. Tanzanian Palmo is a huge exception, you know. Of the 250,000 monks in Thailand, I don't know how many live in caves. Maybe 100? It's not a widespread habit. It's difficult to live in caves. There aren't many caves, and you need lots of people to look after you while you're in a cave. You know,
nobody took after.
In terms of meditation, the people who live in caves are marginal, utterly marginal, and even worse, to tell you the truth, the few I have met have always been the wrong ones. You know, they lived in the cave not to practice solitude, or they lived in the cave because they had relational difficulties, basically.
Yeah.
I think she's an exception. She seems a very nice person. I met her and she seems a very good person. But you will not find many people who live in caves. Never have in Buddhist history. Never will, by my prediction. But, I'm not sure whether he was meditating, so I can't really say. I think it's a myth. You know, there are famous practitioners. Yeah, you have, you know, Padmasambhava and Milarepa and so. But I think it's an interesting experiment to do that for some time. You know, and it's complicated living in a cave. In Thailand, it's complicated. There are very nice caves. They're dry enough that you can live there. You need to make sure that the bats are not in there and so forth. And you need to sure that you're protected from visitors. And you need to sure that you get something to eat because, you know, Thai monks, they don't cook, so they need to be actually looked after. So you need to have somebody who does a lot of negotiating that you can live in your cave. Yeah. Or you can maybe go and live some cave where you have a very long arms round that you can feed yourself. And then you meet once a day when you go to the village to receive food. You leave your cave. But people who actually just live in caves, absolute minority. And in my experience, people who want to do solitary meditation, they need very good looking after. There are other ways you can do solitary meditation. You know, hermitages, which you have secluded spaces, or there's a big temple in the near Bangkok where people do Khao Hong practice, which means they enter a room and they don't leave that room anymore for a long time. But this is something you do as a period. It's like a training. It's not something you spend your life in. Even Tenzin Palmo came up. Even Kalu Rinpoche came out. His teacher kicked him out, yeah?
For 3 years she didn't go out.
Yeah.
When she was told her mother died and she asked her to come and say goodbye, she didn't come.
Yeah.
7 years?
No, 12 years, but 3 years of Prishut.
Yeah.
No,
but there are many other yogis that live in this village of Milarepa and spend 20 years, 30 years in caves.
I didn't mean many people in caves, and I looked around.
This particular village is something that is
Well, actually, Milarepa's lineage I have some familiarity with. You know, I was in Tibet. I was in many Kagyu monasteries. Most of them are not caves. Yeah. Generally, they have some hermitage part. You have a main monastery which does the business, and then you have a retreat monastery which is fed by the main monastery, but which doesn't do the business of the main monastery. So, and sometimes the retreat place has a couple of caves associated. But most of the cave meditators, this is a very small minority of people in caves. And this is not, you know, Buddha suggested that you spend some of your time in solitude, but he also said very clearly you should connect with people. People who spent the afternoon in solitude were then meeting with other people in the same evening, or they spent a long time in solitude, but after 3 months they came back and shared what they had to share. Yeah, so there is a wider sense of communality understood as an implicit relationship, even for people who live for some time of their practice in caves. But I don't think you need to think of living in a cave, frankly.
I don't believe me.
Well, you should also not think that because you're not wanting to live in a cave, you shouldn't be able to meditate, or, you know, there's many ways of meditating without caves. Can we make a break, people?
Okay.
5 minute breaks and then sitting, okay?
Lunch
is going to be on time, but we'll have a quick break. Thanks for your interest, but we need to keep a little bit to the schedule.